Bram Weinstein phrased that exactly right. They needed to survive a kickoff. And wow, wasn't that something at the end of the game, where now it's, with new rules, almost impossible to recover an onside kick. Seattle recovered an onside kick. And at that point, you knew they couldn't stop them, and they had a field goal kicker, so they needed only, 10, 15 yards to set up a game winner. And the new rules also include where you can line up. And there was a technicality on where one of their defenders lined up on the onside kick, and he was offsides, as it turned out, and they had to do it again, and this time Washington finally recovered, though it was not an easy one. They finally were able to salt it away and come away with an incredible victory, 17-15. Not just the way the game played out, but what it means for a football team that was dead in the water at 2-6, and now with the 3-game winning streak, has, grab your steering wheel tightly, a 45% chance of making the playoffs. 45% chance. This is how the league works. You can stink for half the year, but you get hot at the right time. Who knows? The New England Patriots were in the same boat as Washington in the first couple of months of the season. Now they're being talked about as a Super Bowl team. I'm not ready to say that about Washington, but playoffs right now look to be a very real possibility. And we'll talk to Trevor Maddich more about that coming up in less than 20 minutes. Bram Weinstein, who called the game last night here on ESPN 630, will join me at 10:20 as we roll to 11 o'clock today. Tony Kornheiser will do a show on a Tuesday. And I doubt Tony was up for the end of this, but maybe he was. Maybe he actually did gut this out and see what turned out to be just an unbelievable finish. So let's look at how all of this unfolded. And it really is remarkable where you look back on certain plays and say, well, they didn't seem big at the time, but they turned out to be huge plays. And this is a play that happened in the second quarter. Now, Washington is down in this game 7-3, and there's been an exchange of turnovers. And this is what leads to a huge play by Landon Collins, as now Seattle has the ball. They're driving, and maybe they can take a commanding lead here, 14-3, and Collins makes this play. We call it Collins on Collins crime.
Wilson has to escape a pocket that collapses, dumps it off underneath Alex Collins. Popped out by Landon Collins. Ball is loose. There are four burgundy jerseys on the ground, and they've got a fumble. Big turnover for Washington's defense.
Yeah, so right there, they get the turnover back. There was an interception by Jamal Adams, and Seattle has the ball. And, you know, they're in a position to drive and take over on a Washington team that really wasn't in a position to score a lot of points last night. Seattle was giving up a lot of short plays, but they weren't giving up the big plays. And if Washington was going to score, it was going to have to be methodical, which they have been doing with these long drives. And we'll get to time of possession, which was ridiculous, 41 minutes for Washington, and they almost doubled the number of plays that Seattle had and all that. But what that did was it set up a go-ahead touchdown, which we'll get to in a second. But I wanted to play this from Ron Rivera on Landon Collins, who is considered to be a safety, wants to be called a safety, but is really more of a linebacker now. And the fact that he's playing in that position if you look at the turnaround, what they've done defensively, when the early part of the season where they looked terrible, especially on third downs where they were historically bad, the way that he's playing right now, Landon Collins, making a huge difference. This was Rivera last night on Collins.
He's doing the things that we feel that he has the perfect skill set for, and that's the Buffalo, the big nickel position. It's really just a drop-down safety. So if you guys say that once in a while, he'll be happy. But, you know, it's what he really is. He's the drop-down safety that's already in the box. You see it. You see on those short underneath passes how physical he is as a tackler. You know, how he's around the ball. He's a good blitzer coming off the edge for us. Very heady player, knocked that ball loose, and we were able to recover it. I mean, that's the kind of production that position needs, and it's a position that's going to play. If there are 60 plays, it's going to play at least 50, 55 of those plays. So, you know, the guy's done a great job for us.
There's nothing new about that position. I'm going to give you a name, see if you remember. Sua Cravens. Washington took him in the second round out of USC in 2016, so that's almost six drafts ago. And that's what they called him. They called him the Buffalo Nickel. He was a hybrid between a safety and a linebacker. And this was supposed to be a position that everybody was now going to have because tight ends were becoming such a part of the game. And he was a little big to be a safety, 6'1", 224 pounds, and a little small to be a linebacker. But he would be the guy covering tight ends and players coming over the middle. And unfortunately, he had a number of issues, some of them mental issues, as a matter of fact, and was out of the league playing only 16 games, played 11 games here, sat out a year, played a year with Denver, only five games, and has not played since. But this is a position that they've been looking to fill for a long time. Landon Collins may not want to be considered that, so if he's called the Buffalo Nickel and that upsets him, so what? He's playing well at that position, and I think if you look at the way this team has turned around defensively, I think you can point very much at number 26 and what Landon Collins has been able to do. All right, now here's where the complexion of the game completely changes. So after they get the turnover there, after Landon Collins forces the turnover, that sets up a J.D. McKissic touchdown pass from Taylor Heinicke. And McKissic has been great, both catching the ball and running the ball. He scored both touchdowns for Washington last night, and he scored the first of his two with just 56 seconds left in the first half. So they go into the locker room, seemingly with a nice little 10-7 lead. And then a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
Joey Sly on for the extra point. That got blocked, and it is down on the ground and picked up by Seattle, and they are running the other way with it. John Bates is the last chance to stop a two-point play for Seattle, and they won't. All the way goes Rasheed Green. A blocked extra point is returned all the way for a Seattle score.
So do you realize how much the game changed on what was supposed to be a routine extra point? You not only have a swing from what should have been 10-7 to now an incredible 9-9 score, but now you've lost Joey Sly for the game. And according to Ron Rivera, who was on his radio show on WJFK this morning, they've lost him for at least 3 weeks with a hamstring injury. But more importantly, for the purposes of this game, now you're not only in a tie game, but you don't have a kicker. You don't have any kicker to kick even extra points. That was discussed with Lisa Salters with Ron Rivera at halftime, but ultimately they decided not to do this. So this is Rivera on what their kicking options were after discussing it with special teams coach Nate Kayser.
Nate came to me and told me that we didn't have any, we didn't have a field goal or an extra point kicker. I did ask Nate if Tress could drop kick, and no. So that wasn't there. I'm serious. I did ask, and that wasn't there. So, unfortunately. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see how bad Joey is, and we have to see who's out there.
Yeah. So there'll be a kicking caravan in Ashburn today, as again Rivera confirming on his radio show today that Sly is out for 3 weeks. The drop kick has actually been done. Doug Flutie did that at the end of his career with the New England Patriots, but they were not going to ask him to do that. So. Here we go. Now we got a totally different game with no kicker. They don't need no stinking kicker. They don't have a kicker. There's no kicker. Nobody can kick an extra point even. So in the third quarter, J.D. McKissic goes in for a touchdown run. So now we got 15 points on the board for Washington. This may be the most important scoring play of the game.
So I think we got the answer about the extra points. Washington is going for two. Heinicke in the gun, Gibson to his right, three wide receivers to the left, Carter, McLaurin, Humphreys. In the slot to the right, Thomas. Humphreys comes in motion. Heinicke, handoff Gibson right off the left side, over the goal line. Two-point conversion is good. 17-9, Washington.
Okay, so the 17 points there proved to be big because, again, you don't have a kicker. So at the end of the game, where they're in a position to kick a field goal, a 30-yard field goal, I don't understand how you can't kick a 30-yard field goal. I remember this. Sonny Jurgensen's last game at RFK Stadium. They're playing the Bears. They're already in the playoffs. The Bears are terrible. They're rolling up the score. And Mark Mosley's got a sore leg, so they want to save him for the playoff game the following week in Los Angeles. And Deacon Jones, Hall of Fame defensive end, playing his last year in the NFL for good old George Allen, says, "I can kick the extra point." He's like, you know, 6'5", big lumbering guy. And Allen says, "Well, okay." Sonny says, "I'm not going to hold for that." And in those days, the quarterback was the holder. We'll talk to Trevor Maddich more about that coming up in about 10 minutes because he was part of the whole operation, being the long snapper. But Sonny didn't want to do it, so Joe Theismann comes in. Theismann gets the hold, and sure enough, Deacon Jones kicked the extra point. If Deacon Jones could kick a freaking extra point, couldn't they find somebody to do that? But no, they didn't. So it means that at the end of the game, where they could have salted it away with a 30-yard field goal, they're forced to, on fourth and goal from the 3-yard line, to throw a pass to Logan Thomas, which looked to be a touchdown. It looked to be a touchdown, but replay reared its ugly head, and they found some angle where the tip of the ball may have touched the ground. Incomplete pass. And that gives life to a former MVP, guy who may wind up in the Hall of Fame. He's quarterbacked in 2 Super Bowls, won one of them. And this is what happens when you give him an opportunity to tie the game. They're down 8 points, and you're playing that prevent defense, the defense that prevents you from winning. They hit a big play, and then this happens.
First and 10 at the 32. Wilson takes the snap, steps back. Now steps up through the pocket, throws down the center of the field, wide open, Freddie Swain, touchdown Seattle, a 32-yard touchdown pass with 15 seconds to go, and the Seahawks are a 2-point conversion away from tying this.
How does that happen? He's standing in the middle of the goal line. There's nobody around him. And he catches a wide-open touchdown pass. So now Seattle's down 2. Now, incredibly, this is the first time all year that they've attempted a 2-point conversion. And it's a good thing because they, I guess, were not in great practice for this. And Kendall Fuller winds up making the game-saving play.
Wilson, right leg, up and down, takes the snap. Plenty of time, surveying, looks over the middle. That is thrown into the end zone and is picked off! Kendall Fuller picked it off! And Washington maintains their lead. Now they just need to survive a kickoff.
Yeah, and again, we went through that there was a penalty on the first recovery on the onside kick and nearly a second legal recovery, but didn't happen. And Washington survives. And as the late, great Jim Valvano said, it's just about surviving and advancing. So this was an expletive-filled, but a very happy Ron Rivera's speech in the locker room to his players.
Everything we need is in this room. Sir. Everybody in this room we need. We've got to work together, stay together, and be the team that we can be. We will not take it from anybody. I don't give a shit how they stack it against us. We're whipping. Now let's play football. Here we go. Team all 3. 1, 2, 3.
Team!
So off they go. And yeah, he's right. I mean, it's everybody they need is in the room. Now, they need a kicker. There's going to be a new kicker in there. 4 of them. They went through 5 in 2000. So they're threatening that kicker record, but we'll see. We'll see who shows up. Maybe Chris Blewett will come back. I mean, who knows? You know, there aren't a lot of guys out there. But they're down to their 4th string center. Keith Ishmael had to play about half the game because Wes Schweitzer, who's now the 3rd guy playing center for them, went out with some type of an ankle injury. I don't know whether he'll be back when they play at Vegas on Sunday, but he's out, and they are really thinning out. But, you know, it's next man up. That's the NFL. And Rivera was talking about this at 2-6, and everybody went, yeah, right. That he said, look, I don't know where we're going to be, but if we can hang in there, we got 5 division games to end the year. So last night after the game, he said, well, you know, you were talking about this a while ago. Did you talk to your team where you are right now and where you can be in the playoff hunt?
No. What we talked about was really about positioning. You know, we've got 1 more game and then we've got the 5-game round robin. I mean, you know, we're going to have to, you know, take on the Raiders and get ready for them. And then we'll worry about the next 5 games.
Well, here's the way it lines up. The Raiders did have that huge win over Dallas on Thanksgiving, which, you know, look at it two ways. One, the Raiders got themselves out of free fall, which they were in after the firing of their coach, John Gruden, and Henry Ruggs, a horrible incident where he was drunk and plowed into a woman, killing her and her dog at 155 miles an hour. I mean, that organization has been through even more turmoil than this one off the field. But they did right things and pulled off a win at Dallas. It also, though, puts them, Washington, in a position where they're now can consider being a division title winner again because they got the two shots at Dallas. So after Vegas, they got Dallas here on the 12th. They win both those games. I mean, this town is going to be nuts. Then they go to Philadelphia on December 19th. The Eagles look terrible against the Giants on Sunday. And I like Jalen Hurts, but, you know, the more you see of him, the less you're convinced that he's a starting quarterback in the league. Then you got a Sunday night game at Dallas the day after Christmas. Then Philadelphia here the day after New Year's. And then they finish up at the Giants. Now, they've blown those kind of games against the Giants before where all they had to do was win and get in. And they blew it against a team that either had clinched something or had nothing to play for. And you don't know. But, you know, it lines up for them in a way that December now gets very, very interesting around here. It looked like a dead month in October, but as we are about to turn the calendar into December, it looks crazy. And they're doing it with this formula. They've done this the last 3 weeks, all three games. They dominate time of possession. They dominate number of plays. They had almost twice as many plays last night as Seattle did. Almost twice as many. What was the ratio here? 79 to 45. 79 for Washington, 45 for the Seahawks. And remember when third down was a disaster? They held the Seahawks to 4 for 12 last night. 4 for 12 on third down, including five straight three and outs. And the time of possession is 41 minutes, 40 seconds for Washington, just 18 minutes and 20 seconds for Seattle. Here's Heinicke.
If we can, you know, hold the ball for 40-plus minutes, that's phenomenal. But we know that, you know, some of these defenses, we're not going to be able to do that. We're going to have to find another way. So, you know, I think we've done a great job these last 3 weeks of finding a way to win, and that was our way.
Yeah, and they did it old-school style. Antonio Gibson with a Rigo-like performance, 29 carries, 111 yards, 3.8 yards a carry, and one run of 17 yards. We'll talk to Trevor Maddich more about this incredible game last night. Bram Weinstein will join me in just over an hour. This is the Monday Morning Football Show. I'm Andy Poland. Don't go away. Bram Weinstein here on ESPN 630 last night. What was supposed to be a routine extra point totally changed the complexion of the game, and who knows, maybe the season, with Joey Sly out for at least 3 weeks with a hamstring injury, as confirmed by Ron Rivera today. The perfect person to talk about this is Trevor Maddich, who joins us after every game here on the Monday Morning Football Show and was the trigger man for what was supposed to be a routine operation, and was, because nobody noticed that they kicked extra point after extra point when Trevor did the snapping. But last night, everything went kablooey. What do you make of what happened, and how does that happen?
Well, that happens because the Seahawks field goal rush team, or PIT rush team, was on they overloaded on Washington's left side. The two guys on the far left side of the protection unit had four guys to block. When that happens, you got to block the three guys on the inside by getting big and extending your arms out and taking the hit and falling backwards and getting a lot of pain. Mm-hmm. But you block three guys and leave the guy on the widest on the outside unblocked, and he has the farthest to go. But they didn't do that. They left the guy on the inside free and blocked the three guys on the outside. He came free, and he's the one that got the block. So that's a problem. And then once that happens and they recover it, remember that now you've got basically five offensive linemen in there, plus a holder, plus a kicker. That's seven guys. That leaves four guys that are the size of tight ends to chase them down. So you don't have a full coverage team there. And so the kicker, bless his heart, did his level best to run out there, but he's not used to sprinting like that, and he ended up pulling his hamstring. So they'll end up with a new kicker. The question is, who is on the street right now that could come in. They've got a list of guys.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they're going to have a fourth kicker come in cold now.
No question. And Chris Blewett, you know, he had his own lineman on some of his kicks. But block kicks have been a problem this year, and maybe not all the fault of the kicker from what I hear you saying here.
Well, no. I mean, that one was a protection one. There were at least one of those ones with Blewett, if not two, were the protection unit inside got pushed back two steps.
Mm-hmm.
As a rush unit, what you're taught is the interior guys drive two steps forward, then stop and jump and put your hands up. And they were able to do that. And if you get that two steps forward before you jump, you can get the ball in this trajectory before it can clear the line of scrimmage. The part of the problem, with Blewett is that he also kicked it low. So guys didn't have to reach out to block it sometimes with that guy.
Yeah.
They just had to get their helmet in the way. And he had three kicks blocked in 2 weeks. Now, the rest of the operation, there's some issues as well. For example, the snap on the block that was returned for the 2 points the other way yesterday wasn't a great snap. It wasn't bad, but if I were the snapper, I'd be looking at that and say, you know, that was partly my fault, right? So the whole operation has yet to really snap into place.
Yeah, and they drafted this guy Cheeseman. They had a good snapper for a long time and decided to move on with a guy they drafted. Unusual for a snapper to be drafted. And so now they're in a mess. It's amazing, Trevor, with all the kicking problems they've had this year, hasn't really cost them a game, but last night the complexion totally changes. And what really puzzled me is that there was no backup plan. You know, kickers do get hurt. They pull muscles, and they didn't have any other option to they just had to totally abandon extra points and field goals because of it.
Well, they would have had to have their punter, Tress Way, be the kicker.
Yeah.
And he's got a range of about 30 yards or so as a kicker. He does practice that a little bit.
Yeah.
The problem is you can't really fully have your punter practice to become an effective kicker because you'll wear his leg out in practice if you do that. You need to have him use his opportunities to practice punting, not to split it between punting and kicking enough to where his kicking would be really good. And so I think every NFL team, unless they have one of those rare punters that also was a great kicker in college at the same time, and there are guys like that, but there are very few. Unless you have one of those guys, every team would be in this position because you can't carry an extra kicker just in case this happened, because then you take that roster spot or that practice squad spot from somebody else that you might need a lot more likely.
Yeah, also something that's changed, I don't want to say recent years, but probably the last 15, used to be that the quarterback was the holder, often the starting quarterback, and then they changed to punters. Why was that?
Partly because you don't want quarterbacks practicing as being a holder enough to really be super proficient at it. Most holders in college are quarterbacks, although they're moving to more punters that way. But again, it's a matter of practice time. You see all the time a dedicated snapper, holder, and kicker with the punter being the holder, practicing off on their own all the time.
Mm.
And they goof around a lot, too. You know, we used to practice with Eddie Murray, and Gus Frot was the holder, actually. He wasn't the punter. But we used to practice super fast field goals.
Oh.
So instead of getting it off at 2.2, we try to get it off in 1.9 or less.
Wow.
It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is a lot. It's like the instant that ball literally touches grass, it's kicked it, it's out of there. But we're just sort of goofing around with that, but that serves a purpose too.
Yeah.
Because then you slow it down a little bit, and it doesn't seem fast anymore. It seems slow. But the thing is, you could do that, and at the time, I wasn't able to do any practicing on the offensive line, or not very much, because I had an elbow issue for my first training camp with Washington, and North Turner would not allow me to even run the scout squad. I wanted to. He wouldn't let me because as a long snapper, I needed to be healthy, and my elbow was messed up for 3 years.
Yeah.
And so we were over there doing that, and that's one of the reasons our operation was so good, was that we had more practice instead of the snapper practicing somewhere else and then running over and being the being the snapper, getting some practice there. It gives you more focused preparation with the punter as the holder.
And all is good until there's an injury. But, you know, hey, that's football, next man up. And, you know, give them a lot of credit. I would say that what they did was miraculous in that they knew they couldn't kick a field goal or an extra point and still had, and I don't know how you felt about the Logan Thomas play at the goal line there. I thought it was a catch. But even with everything stacked up against them, they fought hard and they found a way to win that game.
You know what? They were just a hot mess before the bye, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
It was hard to look at this team before the bye and see a way that they could actually string together a number of wins. It just didn't see it. Then they came out after the bye, and they're playing as well as almost any team in the NFC. Also the SEC. Georgia looking pretty good right now as a team, and they'll be playing against a lot of those guys in a couple of years. But but it's just a different team after the bye. And the way that they won this game is similar to the way that they've won all three of them since the bye, where the turnovers on offense were limited. And that's important because in the games that they lost, there were a lot of interceptions, a lot of fumbles. In the games that they won, I believe Taylor Heinicke in five wins only had two interceptions combined. Mm-hmm. And so those kinds of things really changed. And the offense was able to string together long drives, keep the defense fresh, control time of possession. And then when the defense came out there, they were able to put their ears back and just get after the opposing offense. And they were fresh when they did it. So this is the formula that they have won with since the bye.
Yeah.
Strong defense, complementary offense, don't make big mistakes. And if they'd have done that before the bye, who knows what this record might be.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost 80s football, where you run the ball effectively, you eat the clock, you keep your defense off the field, and you find a way to win what turned out to be a 17-15 type of game. The 35-31 games maybe don't happen for you, but this is a winning formula for them right now.
It is a winning formula, and really it comes down to Taylor Heinicke.
Mm-hmm.
Before the bye, Heinicke would wait to make the big play.
Yep.
And he exposed the ball to the other side. Even when he scrambled, if he didn't recognize what he saw on the scramble, he would just keep looking around, see somebody that looked like he was wearing the same helmet that he had on, and throw the ball over in that direction. And some of the time, it was picked off, especially in the red zone where things got compressed. And that really, really hurt them. So before the bye, he had a lot of yards. Or plenty of yards anyway. The team moved the ball between the 20s, they get into the red zone, and too often they'd make that big mistake. Well, the difference in Heinicke after the bye is that both from the pocket and on the scramble, he knows exactly what he wants to do, and he does it decisively. And if he's not sure, he doesn't hang around and try to figure it out while the play's going on. If he's not sure, he just takes off. What that does is limit the big mistakes. And also it brings into play something that young quarterbacks usually take a while to figure out, and that is you're better off making a good play fast and decisively than to wait around to try to make a great play. Because when you do that, very often you'll end up making a big mistake too. So there's the biggest difference in Heinicke before and after the bye.
Yeah, and he's, as he says, he's playing the way he used to play in the backyard. They gave him the green light to do that, stop talking about him as a game manager. And, what a difference it has made. We're talking to Trevor Maddich here on the Monday Morning Football Show. And Trevor, of course, played a long time in the NFL. You've seen quarterbacks come and go. And this guy looked like he was just passing through as an emergency option. As the games go on, and the games get more important, and he continues to play, as Ron Rivera says, consistently, and that's what he's looking for. I mean, we're getting closer and closer to seeing him as the guy for next year for sure, right?
Right now, I think they should not be in a hurry to replace him. Certainly, they should not be in a hurry to package draft picks to move up to take some other quarterback in the hopes that he might be better. Because keep in mind that Heinicke is really like a rookie almost. This is his 12th start. So he's kind of like a rookie, except he has a lot of years' experience in the league as a backup, especially with this offense in Carolina with offensive coordinator Scott Turner there and here. And that means he knows the offense a lot better than a rookie might. And as I said before the bye, that they shouldn't be in a hurry to be replacing him. And the reason is you could see that the mistakes that he made are young guy mistakes, and they are correctable mistakes. And if you see a young guy making correctable mistakes, correct those mistakes. And on a path to getting better every week, then you've got a reason to believe that that trajectory will continue. And you saw that from him even before the bye, even as he was making some of those big mistakes in the red zone. And so I think he's got the ability to be more than a good quarterback for this team going forward. Now, is he the Peyton Manning? Well, who is, really? I mean, let's apply a fair standard to the guy. But while they're looking for that kind of guy, that Peyton Manning, that Tom Brady, I don't think they should mortgage the players around him by giving up a bunch of draft choices to go up and get somebody else, especially in this draft. I mean, I'm looking at this draft right now of quarterbacks, and there are some very good quarterbacks. And, you know, there are some guys that are just super exciting. I think the best one of them, frankly, is Bryce Young of Alabama. Well, I don't think he's eligible to come out this year. I think next year he is. He's undersized, but he's got some skills that are just astonishing. But either way, about Taylor Heinicke, another thing to look at him as a potential longer-term solution until they find that Peyton Manning without having to trade up for him. It's how the team responds to him.
Yeah, they do.
I mean, they believe in him. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And when you look at, again, the great coaches, when they have a quarterback competition, which in the NFL is very rare, but it's very common in college, the great coaches will sometimes continue the competition into the season to see who really steps up under the big lights and grabs the confidence of the team around him. And that is a big factor in deciding who will be that starter. And right now, Taylor Heinicke has the belief and the confidence of his players. He inspires them.
Let me ask you about Landon Collins, who Rivera referred to last night as a Buffalo nickel, which is a position that we were actually talking about 5 years ago with a guy named Sua Cravens. Remember, they drafted him in the second round at USC.
Yeah.
Didn't work out for a variety of reasons. I thought that was a new position in the NFL that everybody was going to have, and then you don't hear much about it. But in moving him to that, and he doesn't like to be called that, he wants to be a safety, and Rivera says, call him a safety once in a while, you'll make him happy. His turnaround in the position that he's playing, Trevor, to me, that seems to have made a huge difference in that defense.
Andy, it really has. And part of the reason is that it solves a problem that they haven't been able to solve for a while, and that is the linebacking core has been a liability.
Yep.
Especially in coverage. They're just not explosive. And opposing offenses have targeted them successfully. So they draft Jamin Davis, a physical freak linebacker out of Kentucky, but he didn't play very much football in Kentucky. And so he's still learning the game. He's not ready yet. When he is ready, he will have that kind of physical ability, that kind of speed and sideline to sideline range. But you've got to be able to trust him with his assignments, and he's being targeted now when he's on the field. So having Landon Collins move up into that position where he's a pseudo linebacker gives you a guy that's very experienced there. And if you take a big, little bit slow safety at this point in his career, nothing personal, Landon, but hey, and moving the linebacker, instead of a big, slow safety, you have a small, fast linebacker.
Yep.
Now you've got a guy at that level of the defense that can really run compared to the other guys that are playing at that level of the defense. And it has made a huge difference. Another reason it's made a huge difference is that really it puts three safeties on the field for Washington. And so the offense can never really know, with the same personnel group, without the defense changing guys, never really know if he's going to be accounted for as a linebacker on this play, or if he's going to be accounted for as a defensive back on this play. And that means they can disguise coverages really well. And that's been a big reason why the secondary has improved in its performance over the course of since the bye.
Yeah.
Because they've got more options and they've learned how to do that using him as that hybrid type of player that the offense can't really pinpoint on any given moment.
Let me hit you with one college question before I let you go. Brian Kelly leaving Notre Dame for LSU for the Mel Tucker one-size-fits-all $10 million, 10-year, $95 million contract. This is different from the others in that Notre Dame is theoretically alive for the national championship. What are your thoughts on this, and what do you think this means going forward, not just for the two schools, but for college football in general?
Well, it's been a seismic season for coaching changes, right? Oklahoma's coach, Lincoln Riley, goes off to USC.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, you know, just a whole bunch of stuff like that that's been just massive. And there's more massive stuff to come, I think. But Kelly going to LSU is a real head-scratcher for me. I fully understood Riley going to USC. Makes sense in so many ways. But Kelly is a Midwestern guy. He has no experience at all down in the South. Part of the role of a head coach is to be relatable to boosters and to the administration and to high school coaches down there. So that's something that Kelly's going to have to learn because it's a different personality down there. I'm sure he will learn it. He'll be okay. It's going to be critical that he hire assistants that understand the recruiting down there that can really help him with a lot of that interface between the head coach's office and everybody else that have to love him, right? Now, LSU, I think he went because he wants to win the national championship. Of course, you also go because I don't know if Notre Dame was willing to pay that much money to anybody.
Right.
But you get all that money. But the last three coaches at LSU all won the national championship. Nick Saban, Ed Orgeron, and Les Miles. And two of those, Miles and Orgeron, didn't really win a whole lot anywhere else before or since. Mm-hmm. LSU, you know, you can hit a three-wood in any direction and hit 50 recruits and end up in the NFL one day. And so I'm guessing that he figured he maxed out his potential in the current college climate at Notre Dame and decided to go take the payday and have a chance to add national champion to his resume. But the risk there is that he ends up without a home, because Notre Dame right now, I mean, they appreciate that he's become the most winning coach ever at Notre Dame, but it might be a little while before they end up liking him again, because he just bugged right out.
Yeah, and that would be my follow-up on the players, in that you are telling them, hey, you know, we've gone all this way, I've gotten you to the doorstep of possibly, I mean, there'd be a long shot, but of possibly being in the 14 playoff and winning the national championship, and somebody gave me $95 million, so I'll see you later. Is there anything college football can do to maybe, you know, make it impossible to hire a coach this early, or is that just the way it's going to work from here on out?
It has to work that way. You can't really interfere with the market like that. Mm-hmm. As a practical matter, you know, the courts won't allow you to do it, because that would be an illegal restraint of trade if there were some sort of way to do that. But you know, where's your home? You know, who? It's like when Brett Favre left Green Bay, they were mad at him. He wanted to play for the Vikings. He had to go to the Jets first and head over to the Vikings. And Green Bay was mad at him. Now, they eventually welcomed him back in with open arms, right? But eventually, when you retire, you want a home. You want some place that loves you, man. You want an office there that you can be the ambassador, like Steve Spurrier has at Florida. And you can just live out your life just really enjoying that, if that's where you want to be. And you compromise that when you do something like this. You also compromise the players. And you're right. I mean, it's very possible that Notre Dame could get into the top four. In last week's ranking, they were number six. And Ohio State will probably get bounced for number two behind them. That puts Notre Dame at number five, right?
Yep.
Then if Georgia beats Alabama in the SEC championship game, that puts Notre Dame at number four.
Mm-hmm.
All they'd have to worry about is getting jumped from behind, which they probably would if Oklahoma State beats Baylor in the Big 12 championship game. But if Baylor wins that game, then Notre Dame is basically an Alabama loss to Georgia away from making the playoff. And so this is a really curious time to make this announcement.
Yeah, but I guess when somebody puts $95 million on the table, it's hard to say no. I've also heard that Kelly is one of the lower-paid, high-level Division I coaches. You get some of the value, I guess, of being a Notre Dame coach is that you get the name and all that, but you don't necessarily get all the dollars. So.
Well, you get the blessings. And
there you go. You know,
church schools like that. They consider money that goes out, they consider their money sacred funds, and I think rightly so.
Yeah, well,
and there's generally opposition to giving too much to a football coach, regardless of how much money that football coach generates.
Yeah, Gary Williams likes to joke that when he went and coached at Boston College, he took a vow of poverty, but that's
really funny. Yeah, you play for the blessings, you know?
There you go.
Play for the blessings.
Exactly. Good to talk to you, as always. Talk to you next week. Thanks, Trevor.
Thanks, Andy. All right, man.
That's Trevor Matich, who knows an awful lot about what happened last night with the blocked extra point totally changing the complexion of the game. We'll talk a lot more about that with Bram Weinstein at 10:20 as we roll into the Andy Pollin Hour. We got more on the Monday Morning Football Show, and we'll get to some more college and also more of what happened last night in Landover as we continue. Don't go away. Yeah, I think that might have been the offensive play of the game, because of the way things unfolded after Joey Sly pulled his hamstring trying to chase down a blocked extra point. You know, an extra point used to be something you went to the bathroom for. Score a touchdown, go to the bathroom, the extra point's going to be good, nothing to worry about there. But now, well, not just the distance has changed, and that's a part of it, but given the incredibly nightmarish kicking problems that Washington has had this year, you can't take anything for granted, and the entire game changes on that. So if they don't get the two-point conversion, then that means Seattle is able to go down the field as they did on that last drive and put it away with they don't even need the extra point at that point, because they'd have 16 points and they could win the game that way. But that was huge. That forced Seattle to go for two, and the interception was made, and that put it away as it was just a a game that you know, you want to go to bed early when Washington plays on Monday Night Football, and you couldn't. And even with all the shenanigans that went on, the long delay on the instant replay, whether it was a touchdown or not, and all the injuries that happened, where they had to actually cart off J.D. McKissick. You hope that he's going to be okay. It may be a concussion. We don't know. They'll know more later this week. But all those things seem to add up to a game that would take like 4 hours, and it was because of the way that they were able to dominate the time of possession and run the football. I mean, their numbers, and again, if you're not caught up on all these numbers from last night, they're mind-boggling. And if you didn't see the game, they're almost hard to believe that they held the ball for 41 and a half minutes in this game. They ran almost twice as many plays as Seattle did, 79 to 45. And they ran the football as well as you could possibly run it these days. 43 carries for 152 yards. And this is Bill Parcells. This is Joe Gibbs football. This is, you run the ball and you play defense and you keep your defense off the field. And the defense is fresh and the defense makes plays. And they did a great job on Seattle aside from that last drive when they're in that stupid prevent defense. But they forced five and out. Five three and outs for Seattle, which, you know, shouldn't happen to them with a mobile quarterback like Russell Wilson. And I thought Wilson was inaccurate at times. He threw a couple of nice balls, but he's inconsistent with that finger, which he says is 95%. I don't think it's 95%. He had a couple of overthrows last night that are just not like him. And Washington was able to take advantage. And if you look at last year, when they made their run, they did it against backup quarterbacks. Well, maybe now they're doing it against compromised quarterbacks. At least Russell Wilson was. The rest of the way, you're going to see better quarterbacks, including Dak Prescott twice. But they have put themselves in an incredible position off three straight wins and increased their playoff possibilities to 45%. From 2-6 to 45%. If you're just jumping in your car, we had Trevor Maddich on as he comes on every Monday or day after game on the Monday Morning Football Show, which is what we run here now from 9 to 10 day after games. And we talked a lot about the blocked extra point. And he said, if you look at the blocking scheme, and he knows all about this because he was a snapper for 14 years in the NFL, I think four or five of them here. He told you that there was some missed blocking assignments on the outside, which allowed that kick to be blocked. But it's the chain reaction of it changing what should have been a 10-7 game into a 9-9 game. And your kicker, Joey Sly, who you finally found, your third kicker of the year, he's been good, now can't kick for at least 3 weeks, according to Ron Rivera, because he pulled a hamstring. So now they got to get their fourth kicker of the year before they head off to Vegas next week. But, you know, survive in advance, and if they are able to get past the Raiders on Sunday, then it sets up as a December to remember, December into January, because two of the games will be in January, but all five of them division games, Dallas twice, Philadelphia twice, and then the Giants to close out the season. A couple of golf things, and it's somewhat ironic that their names are in the news on the same day, because they are really linked in history. And first is Lee Elder, who passed away yesterday at the age of 87 in California. And he was here for a large part of his life. He ran the Langston Golf Course. And in 1975, he became the first African-American to play in the Masters. And that was a big deal on two fronts here. One, that he was local, and two, that he was making history in this way. And in a very good obit that was done this morning by Lenny Shapiro, my friend Lenny, in the Washington Post. And we had talked about Lee Elder when the Masters happened, because with all the attention on social justice this year, they gave Lee Elder a long overdue honor and allowed him to tee off with the former champions Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player. And so we had talked about his background here, and that he had run the Langston Golf Course for a long time and made Washington his home. But it's hard to believe this, because this is, you know, I was already a teenager when this happened. So this is part of my lifetime. It wasn't until 1972 that Augusta changed the qualifying rules to give an automatic invitation to any player who won on the PGA Tour. Otherwise, he wouldn't have gotten in. And at that point, Augusta had no African-American members and no women. And He qualified for the Masters by winning the 1974 Monsanto Open in Pensacola, Florida, sinking an 18-foot putt on the fourth hole of a sudden-death playoff to defeat Peter Oosterhaus, and that earned him a spot in the Masters. But this is 1975. This is not 1955. 1975, in the run-up to the Masters, Elder said the threats against his life intensified to the point where he rented two houses in Augusta under an assumed name. Like he's having to duck people who want to kill him. You know, Henry Aaron also got death threats a year earlier when he had broken Babe Ruth's home run record. But this is the Deep South into the 70s. And you hope things have changed dramatically since then. But who knows? He competed a number of times more in the Masters. He has best finished 1979 when he finished 17th. He competed on the senior tour, did very well there. But his story is an incredible American story. He was the youngest of 10 children. His father was killed in World War II. His mother died a short time later. He became an orphan and became a golf hustler. That's how he was able to support himself. He dropped out of high school in the 10th grade and supported himself as a caddy and a golf hustler, and as Lenny writes, often in cahoots with the noted gambler and golfer Alvin Thomas, known better as Titanic Thompson. So he was a guy who was sort of a roguish character who managed to fight his way and get noticed by the right people and had an opportunity to become a professional golfer and a trailblazer and someone who should be recognized, passing away at 87. Meantime, Tiger Woods, who was able to play in the Masters because of got people like Lee Elder and Charlie Sifford and people before him, famously won in 1997 and really changed the face of golf. He had that terrible car accident in February of last year, and now he is finally giving interviews. He's supposed to have a news conference later today, but he talked to Golf Digest, and he said that he will never be a full-time player on the tour again. He said he'll pick and choose like Mr. Hogan, Ben Hogan did. Ben Hogan did come back from a terrible car accident and win the U.S. Open, but he was much younger than Tiger. And Tiger said it was 50-50 whether or not he was actually going to lose his leg in the hospital. And here's what he says about the future. He says, I don't have to compete and play against the best players in the world to have a great life. After my back fusion, I had to climb Mount Everest one more time. I had to do it, and I did. This time around, I don't think I'll have the body to climb Mount Everest, and that's okay. I can still participate in the game of golf. I can still, if my leg gets okay, I can click off a tournament here and there. But as far as climbing the mountain again and getting all the way to the top, I don't think that's a realistic expectation. I don't know whether he means winning a major again, which would probably be the Masters, which would be his best shot, or just actually being competitive on the tour. But it looks like in his middle 40s that it's over for Tiger as a competitor. Now, you know, things could change. He could get back out on the tour and the competitive juices start flowing again, and he could try and compete a little bit more often. But I think this is reality. And look, you know, he's lucky to have a leg. And we did have that last hurrah before the car accident, but in winning the 2019 Masters, I think he put an incredible bow on maybe the most exciting career in the history of golf. Jack Nicklaus won more majors, but what Tiger did, he was a comet. And I hope he does get back and play on the tour, because I love watching him play. Coming up, it's the Andy Pollin Hour. Much more on the Washington football team and the incredible win last night. Bram Weinstein will join us at 10:20. Don't go away.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the NFL Draft.
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival, featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.